Hello again, everyone. It's the Lady J, and you are listening to I Never Told You What I Do for a Living, a podcast about work, jobs, careers, all of it. This week, I am joined by my friend Erin, who happens to be the podcast partner of last week's guest, Stella Cheeks. Erin talks about starting a new job and the way that people of our generation, hers and mine, feel about work. We talk about some political stuff. We talk about books at the very beginning. This conversation is all over the place, but in the best way. I think you're really going to enjoy this one, and I can't wait to hear what everyone has to say about it. Erin has really found a way to balance her work and her life together, and so that was the title I decided to give her for this episode. I hope you enjoy episode 9 with Erin, the balancer. All right. Well, I'm joined by my friend Erin. How you doing?
Hello. I'm doing excellent. How are you, Jay?
I'm great. It's Sunday. It's raining. And so I have nothing on the agenda. Isn't that amazing?
That is nice. It was raining literally all day yesterday here, and now it's like beautiful and sunny outside. So I'm sorry, we probably sent it all to you.
That's totally fine, because I did a lot of running around yesterday, and now I have nothing that needs to be done. So Gizmo and I can curl up with a book and just do nothing. So,
That's so exciting. What are you reading? First and foremost, let's get the important things out of the way.
So I recently discovered, and by recently, I mean yesterday, discovered an independent bookstore in Arlington, which I've been here for 4 years and didn't know existed. They've been there for 8, so I feel a little ashamed. And I went in and I read Normal People by Sally Rooney a few months ago. And so I bought her other book, Conversations with Friends. So that's what I've just started.
Oh, cool. All right. I love hearing about what people are reading. It's the best.
What are you reading right now?
I just finished yesterday on my way to record my podcast, Night or Demo, a feminist wrestling podcast. I was on my way to Stella's house to record, and I finished The Testaments on the bus. First and foremost, I do not watch the show The Handmaid's Tale. The world is too depressing. I like my entertainment to not be depressing now, so agreed. I cannot watch the show. But I read the book many years ago because I'm a big reader, and I went to college with a lot of feminists who were like, read this book. And I was like, okay, well, fine, I guess. And like, I enjoyed The Handmaid's Tale when I read it. I love the ending, the symposium on Gilead that everybody complained about for so many years. I loved that ending. I thought it was fantastic. And so I was really excited when it was announced that she had written a sequel to it. And Margaret Atwood is a beautiful writer. I really enjoy her writing style, even when I don't necessarily love the plot or the characters. Like Cat's Eye, I fucking hated that book, but I still read the whole thing because I like what her writing is structured like for most of it, and I like the prose that she chooses to use. Mm-hmm. So I'm like reading The Testaments, and I was like legit like 250 pages in before I was like, oh, okay, I'm in. Now I'm really interested in this. It was just really different than I was expecting. If you've only watched the show, I would not read The Testaments because there are massive spoilers, obviously, because it's a sequel. But it was really interesting. I'm gonna flash forward if you don't want to hear like a kind of contextless spoiler on the book, but she kind of like changes something that was mentioned in the symposium at the end of the first book, and I was like, wait a minute, what the fuck is this? So it was weird. It was like I was expecting a very different book, and in the end I enjoyed what I read, but I wish I had known less, almost, that I had gone and like read The Handmaid's Tale and then immediately read The Testaments for the first time. I think I would have enjoyed it more, but overall I would still recommend people read it. That was good. I also just finished a book of poetry called Deaf Republic. It's on the National Book Award finalist list for poetry this year, 2019. I've read most of the things that are nominated for the National Book Award this year because I was fun employed for 8 months, and so I did a lot of reading. And So I've been making my way through the list, and this is kind of the last one that I have to read of the nominees. And I didn't like it as much as the other ones. And I think it's because I knew it was a finalist. I was expecting so much from it that I like built up these really high expectations in my mind and was like, oh man, I wish again I had just known less and gone in with kind of a more clear mind on it. But I would still recommend it. Deaf Republic is what it's called. Ilya Kaminsky, I believe is the author's name. I've been reading a lot of contemporary poetry because I'm a fucking nerd.
That's awesome. Actually, one of the I thought of you when I was in this independent bookstore. It's called One More Page, and they have a whole wall of stuff that the you know, they have, like, instead of having just one recommendation shelf, they have them in each section.
Yes. Oh, I love that. That's such a good idea.
So they have like poetry recommendations, and it's wild. Like, because I were you the person who tweeted like you should absolutely judge a book by its cover?
Yes, you absolutely should. It is so stupid to say that you should not. Like, it is literally an entire industry is built on people making books accessible and palatable. And like, you can also, this is just like a super, like, it's related but also kind of a rant. There are very specific cover designs for certain kinds of books. And so if you know what you like, you can see a book and identify it as part of a certain genre. And that's smart. And that's really good marketing. And it should be like that. And so the idea that you should not judge a book by its cover, it's like, no. Yeah, sure. When every book was bound in leather and was red, sure. Of course, then you shouldn't judge a book by its cover. The cover meant nothing. Now it totally does. Now cover design is very important. If a book has a bad cover, I won't read it. Like, straight up won't.
The other thing too is when they redo covers, and I'm like, why did you do this?
Sometimes I get it. I hate a cinematic movie cover. I would much rather just have the original book cover. But like, I understand updating it when like with The Handmaid's Tale. The original cover, if you've never seen it, is fucking hideous. It is so bad. It's like, the art makes sense, and for a book that was like brand new and shocking, I think it's a very appropriate original cover, but like, I would not buy that book because of that cover now. And so I understand that, like, updating it to fit like more contemporary taste, that makes a little bit more sense to me. But I agree, like, if you're just going to totally redo a cover, like, why did you have a bad cover in the first place? That was dumb.
One of the things that really jumped out at me in terms of covers when I was in this store is that right up by the front, because it came out very recently, I think maybe even last week or the week before, is Stephen Chbosky's new book, The Imaginary Friend, I think it's called. And it's only his second novel after The Perks of Being a Wallflower. And it's an adult horror novel. And it looks like a Stephen King book. Like, it has the weird, like, it looks like somebody carved the images into it, and it's like the silhouette of someone in a wood, like, kind of far away.
Yeah.
And I just thought about like how amazing the cover of Perks of Being a Wallflower is.
The soft
cover book. It's just all green, and there's this little picture in one corner, and it's just amazing. And it's so iconic and sticks out. And if you see that like flash of green in somebody's stack of books, you're like, I know exactly what that is.
Absolutely. I love that feeling when you're looking through someone's books and you're like, oh yes, I know. I feel that way about House of Leaves. That's like one of my all-time favorite books. And like, I can immediately identify that book on a shelf. I'm like, that person has this book. Have you read it? No, nobody ever has. It's cool.
Well, I feel like now we have to pivot a little bit.
Yeah.
So I always start with the same question. Erin, what is your earliest memory of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Oh, man. I had so many things I wanted to be when I was a kid. I think that maybe should have been like a red flag a little bit. But like, it's funny, I just started a new job, and in the interview process, I was like describing myself and the things that I do now. And the woman who was part of the interview team, who is now one of my coworkers, she was like, wow, you do a lot of stuff. You're kind of like a jack of all trades. And I was like, that is exactly right. That is exactly what I am. And like, that's how I was as a kid too. I wanted to be an astronaut for a really long time, but I'm not very good at math. And I have terrible eyesight. And when I was a kid, like, basically the only path to being an astronaut at the time was you had to be in the Air Force and be like a trained pilot, because it was all people who were training to go up to the ISS. Mm-hmm. And I could never qualify for those programs because my eyesight was so bad. And so really early in life, I had a lesson of like, man, I really want to do this thing, but like my body is betraying me and I just can't. So I remember really wanting to do that. And when I was like, okay, I can't do that. I really wanted to be a judge for a long time. And then I learned you had to be a lawyer first. And I was like, fuck that. Don't want to do that. So it's like, I'm really interested in the end game of this, but don't want to have to go through all of that bullshit. And especially as like a woman and my parents both work in law, I was like, nope, not into that. I'm out. Not interested. No, thank you. So I wanted to do that. And then when I decided I didn't want to do that, I, for a really long time, I don't know how this idea got into my head, but when I was like in elementary school, when people asked me what I was going to be when I grew up, I just told them, I'm going to be the first woman president. Which I guess is still a goal I could have right now, which is sad, but it was a thing that I told people for a long time. They were like, well, how are you gonna do that? I was like, I don't know. I'll figure it out. So I think that's I went through all of those after I decided I didn't want to be president anymore. Again, probably a good call. I wanted to be an actor, and I had an uncle who was a professional actor. He teaches at an international boarding high school now, as their theater director, but he was a touring actor for a really long time. And I don't know, I always loved theater, even when I wanted to be lady president and astronaut and judge, but not lawyer. I still really love theater, and I've always loved musicals. I love Gene Kelly, and I loved Judy Garland as a kid. I still do. Judy's great. You should go see it. Renee Zellweger is a fucking vision. It's so good. My uncle was really, he worked at Disney World for like 10 years and was one of their principal dancers in their parades. And so I went as a kid to Disney just a disgusting amount. For someone who lived in Michigan, I went to Disney like twice a year basically because my uncle worked there. Mm-hmm. And so I really manifested that. He loved Shakespeare. He like instilled a love of Shakespeare in me when I was still wanting to be like lady president / astronaut / judge. And so I think as I got older and was like, oh, I can do this. I don't just have to read it or watch it. I can like actually go out and be this thing. I dedicated to that really early. It was a thing I was really passionate about for a really long time. And I really loved doing. But much like my body betrayed me and I couldn't be an astronaut, and careers betrayed me and I couldn't be a judge without being a lawyer, I was a good actor, and I was really good at that, at the actual part of performing and rehearsing and like the acting part of it. I am not good at the hustle. It really drained me in a way that everyone tells you is going to happen, but you truly cannot understand until you try to do it how destabilizing it is. It's weird. It's weird to hear everyone for the whole time you're studying to be a thing be like, this isn't going to work. You're going to hate this, but you should try, I guess. And it's like, I'm going to be the one. I'm going to be the one that makes it through the other side of this. Truly and sincerely, I wish that when I went to acting school and to the theater programs I went to, like everyone described it as being very hard to be an actor, but no one really simulated what that hustle was like. And I wish someone had done that. I don't really even know what that would look like as someone who has like also taught some theater stuff before. I don't really know how you would simulate that even to be like, other than to make your students like train really fucking hard for an audition and then be like, never mind, this play's not happening. Like, I think that's kind of the only way you can really simulate that kind of like heartbreak and pain, or like you audition everyone in a class and no one gets cast in the show. Like, those are lessons I think that are really important, but how do you build that into an education? Like, it's bizarre. But yeah, that's the last thing I really like wanted to be. Like, it's weird. I like didn't plan to be in the career that I am now. I like legit stumbled backwards into it, which I think maybe is good. I think I like really wanted to be an actor, and I wanted to be a very specific kind of actor. And when that lifestyle was bad for me, it was really deflating. And I had like a real crisis of, who am I? I think I still have that crisis a lot, actually, to be honest, where like I was told as a kid, you have to pick a job and you've got to pick a career and you've got to do it. And that's how that works. And then to pick something that people tell you over and over, you're going to fail. And like, no, I'm not. I'm definitely not. I'm not going to have a backup plan. I'm going to make this work. Cause that's the only way you can make it work, is to not have a backup plan and to try literally as hard as you can, to hear that over and over. And then to fail, ostensibly to fail, in the eyes of what every adult tells you, it rocks you. It rocks you in a way that's really unfair. And I bet that happens with all kinds of fucking careers. I bet that there's every single field that it feels that way, to like dedicate to something and then to just, it's just not what you think it is, or it's exactly what you thought it is and you are not who you thought you were. Like, I think it's really unfair that we place that burden on like 15-year-olds to like, hey, figure out who you are right now, pick a career, go, don't stop until you're dead. Like, man, I hope that I don't do that to people younger than me. Like, I really hope that we're learning as a generation that that's like a really unfair thing to ask of people. Cause like I said, I'm in a career now. I'm really fucking good at my job. I'm really good at my career. But it's because I don't care. Like, I don't fucking care about this career. If you had given me 1,000 guesses, I never, ever would have. For people who don't know, I'm in marketing. I bet you never could have guessed from me describing book covers why you should fucking make decisions based on that kind of instinct. Yeah, I work in marketing for a very large company now. I've just started that job. And I truly think it's because I was just like, oh, I'm good at this, but I don't care. And I've worked very hard to create a work-life balance because I don't give a shit about my career, because I had this like foundational rocking experience of I'm not who I thought I was and neither are careers. And now I have this great career that like, whatever, I could take or leave. And I feel like a lot of people don't feel that way. And I think I'm really lucky that I'm very good at something that it won't rock me if it just ends now, because I don't give a shit about it. That's so mean. I really like my job and I really like where I'm working and I like the work that I'm doing, but it is not a passion. It's not acting. It's not, if someone today was like, we'll give you the exact same salary and you can just be a Shakespearean actor, I would fucking drop marketing in a second because I still have that love. But it's like I said, I think it's just a weird thing that we ask 15-year-olds to choose what to do.
Well, this has been 17 minutes of Erin doing the podcast entirely.
I'm sorry. I realized I was just like,
No, you hit like all of my magic things that I normally ask people about. And I was like, well, I have no questions now.
I realized I got like into that and was like, oh man, I'm doing like a whole ass monologue here.
No, it's
actor,
good though.
It's actor training in me. I'm like, oh man, all right, push through. Also, can you tell I have a lot of improv training where I'm like, fill that space?
I think also it comes from the fact that I'm still trying to figure out what the right balance of response is to people, because I don't want them to think that I'm trying to jump in if I'm just laughing or whatever. Yeah. But at the same time, I don't want them to think that they've lost the connection and they're talking to no one.
Yeah. So. I like checked my screen. I was like, okay, it's still recording. That's a good sign. Actually,
yep.
She's still there. I really like that you do that. Having listened to some of the other episodes, especially the one that you had with Stella, I really enjoyed that one. Can you tell, again, talking about the myth of career, like I think that that's such an important thing for people to be talking about and younger people to be hearing about a lot more now. But I like that. I think that it's funny because you ask these questions that are on their surface very simple. What was the first memory you have of wanting to be something, or how did you get pointed in that direction? And I think that the open-endedness of you just allowing people to talk has brought out this like stream of consciousness that like really works for this. I really enjoy it. Well, people are like, yeah, let me fill this space. You gave me this prompt and here we go.
I think part of it, someone was recently just asking me about how I came up with the concept for the podcast, which seems, no offense to the person who asked the question, kind of almost ridiculous to me. Mostly because there are lots of podcasts about jobs.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
So it's definitely not an original idea, but I think what they were more asking was like, how did you come up with how you were going to frame the podcast? And like anything, you start to change the frame as you go along and have the experience of talking to people. But really what I'm asking is for people to consider their path through work, not necessarily, do you like your job? Do you hate your job? You know, why do we even have jobs? Like, it's not that kind of thing. It's more just, let's talk about how you got from A to B and then B to C and then C back to A and then A to 12. And like, those things I think are mostly, it's just for the fact that I was having these conversations in a non-public forum. And I thought to myself, there are lots of people who feel the same way. So putting it out there would probably be a good thing for someone, whether it's someone who's having a hard time figuring out what they want to do next, someone who's been doing the same thing for a long time and can't fucking do it anymore, or somebody who's really young and is asking, why is somebody trying to make me pick a job and I'm only 17 years old? I don't even have a driver's license yet. Come on, guys.
Yeah, totally. And it's, I feel like our generation are, I mean, you and I are about the same age. We're in our early to mid 30s. Like, our, the way that jobs and careers has shifted as a focus in people's lives, like, there did used to be work-life balance when we were young, if you were lucky and you were part of a economic class that allowed for that kind of thing, which is not true of a lot of people, but is true of some people. Like, there's this, there was this like looseness with the idea of career. Like, you pick something, then you're just in it forever. And it's like, you don't really have to think about it that hard. And then as we got to be in like our 20s, especially during the fucking crash of 08, like, your job became everything. We lived through this economic turmoil in this like really weird time in America where, I mean, it's, it was the Great Depression, only it was, we had a bunch of technology, and like, that we like refuse to actually name it as that, I think has also been horrible. That we're like, oh yeah, it's cool. This isn't like the 20s. No, not at all. It's just extraordinarily similar. You're just in a sort of better time for it to be happening where you're not going to die immediately, but like, also this is horrible. And so we just had this idea of like, you have to eat shit at your job because you are so fucking lucky to have any kind of job at all. And so many people don't have jobs. And so it, I feel like you just got thrown in a way where it's like, just grasp as hard as you can, like grab for something and just do anything you can to keep it, which is such a dangerous thing to teach people. Like, again, I'm very lucky to be in the job that I'm in right now. And it's because I ate shit for so long that I'm in the position that I can take a job like I have now. But I ate shit for 7 years at a job. And like, looking back, describing it to my new coworkers, every single thing I talk about my old job, I just get these horrified looks. I'm like, yeah, you're right. It is fucked up that I dealt with that for so long. It is really bizarre that I had this like hostage anxiety about, I'm going to not have my job. And then what do I do? It's, I really hope that we don't do that to the next generations after us. Like, I think it's really important. Like you were saying, people who are like, who are young and find this and are like, well, it doesn't have to be like that. You don't have to feel that way. It's not.
I think you and I were, and some of the other people who have been on this podcast before are from a very specific demographic of people who were in college when the crash happened. Mm-hmm. And it created this very bizarre dichotomy between, we spent every waking moment of our cognizant life up to that point being told, you have to get good grades so you can go to a good school so you can get a good job. And then suddenly the narrative changed drastically to, you're going to have to take any job you can get because there aren't enough jobs to like feed everybody out there right now.
And
like,
also
not enough to go around.
And also, congratulations, you have $100,000 in debt from a college that you felt obligated to go to because we told you absolutely had to do that in order to get jobs that no longer exist. Like, man, man, did we fuck this up?
And I'm also curious because something that I hear often in the industry of marketing, there is a lot of there's sort of like a line drawn in the sand between people who think there's value in higher education and people who don't. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who work in marketing who are like, a degree in marketing, I don't know how valuable that is really, because the industry changes so fast. Like, how could you, being away from actually working in marketing for 4 years could be super what's the word I'm looking for? Just it would, you would end up really behind the curve. I
absolutely
think.
And also, like, my degree has fucking nothing to do with marketing. Like, legit nothing. When I first got hired at my first job, that, like, where I, okay, so here, the fun thing for this about me, for this podcast for me, is that, like, when I was at my eat shit job for 7 years, like, no one really knew what I did. I just, like, didn't talk about it ever because I was like, this job sucks. It's just like any other shitty job. No one wants to hear about it. And so like, my husband didn't know what I did for, like, a really long time. People would ask him and he was like, I don't know. I have no idea. She doesn't ever talk about it. But I started with a company working data entry. And because I was still actively working as an actor at the time. So I was like, I need this flexible job schedule. I was there for, like, literally 2 weeks and got an opportunity to go to Liverpool and was like, peace out. I'm going to Liverpool. And so they were like, okay, I guess we'll let you do this. I don't know why. I have no idea in hindsight why they let me go, but they did. And so I went to Liverpool for 9 days. And when I came back, the first day I was back, someone had gotten very sick on the edits and corrections team and was like, I don't know when I'm coming in. I don't know if I'm ever coming in again. And so I happened to be there while this crisis was happening. And they were like, hey, Erin, you're brand new. You barely know how to do this other job. Do you want to do this editing job? I was like, yeah, that's way better. Of course I want to do that. And so I just, like, stumbled into this career in editing. It was like, I just literally happened to be in the right place at the right time. And they were like, okay, you're competent enough that you can do this one thing. We think you can do this other thing. And I got all of my career training there at this job. Like, again, learning to eat shit in many ways. But, like, I also think part of marketing is, like, everyone thinks of marketing and they think of fucking Mad Men, of the people in a room talking about shit. Like, yeah, that's part of marketing. And I think that is probably why people get degrees, is because they're like, oh, I'm picturing this thing and I want to get good at this part of marketing. But marketing is all kinds of fucking shit. Like, my team could technically be considered part of the IT and tech side, because that's also part of marketing, is, like, the way that your, for instance, online mobile apps work. Like, all that shit is controlled through a marketing team. And I'm a digital optimization supervisor. That is a marketing thing. And, like, I think people have this very narrow idea of how marketing works. And, like, if you actually want to work in marketing, the way to do it is to do like I did and, like, take a shitty job, get all of the on-the-job training, and then I always almost call it auditioning. It is not auditioning. This is not acting. Interview with another company. Like, that, again, that idea that was drilled into our heads as kids of, like, you pick a company and you work there till you die, I think has hurt so many people. Like, go to a company, get the training that you need to upgrade your skills and upgrade your salary level, stay there for a year and a half, and then fucking peace out. They don't owe you, they think that they don't owe you shit. And so you should feel like, I don't owe them shit either. And I think a lot of people would be really advantaged by thinking of that in basically any field at this point, but especially something that's, like, fast moving and cutthroat in a way that marketing is both displayed to be and is in many ways.
How do you feel then about this idea that I see all the time on the internet that, like, millennials don't stick around in jobs for very long?
They shouldn't. They shouldn't. First of all, they do. They're, like I was saying before, I had that, like, hostage anxiety about leaving my old job.
Yeah, they stick around way longer than they should.
Absolutely, 100%. And, like,
especially women.
Yes,
like, people of color, any sort of underrepresented group definitely sticks around in a job longer than they should.
Because you understand, first of all, you do feel very grateful that you have a job, because you understand how fucking hard it is to get a job when you're not a white straight dude. Like, sorry, not sorry. That is absolutely easier in the job market. You just get more meetings. People see you and they're like, oh, you're immediately competent. Your skills aren't questioned in the same way. And so that hostage anxiety makes people of color, it makes women, it makes queer people stay in jobs a lot longer, because they're like, it is going to be such a goddamn nightmare to find a new job. And, like, and of course there are exceptions too, where, like, people are treated as, like, model minorities, and then they're hired to do things that it's like, why? The whole system is fucked up. I was like, I cannot get into this right now. The long and short of it is the system is super fucked up. And I think that we, like, know and appreciate that. And so we do stay places that we fucking shouldn't. Like, yeah, a year is enough time. That's fine. Start looking for another job after a year. That's cool. Unless you love what you do and you love where you work and you think you're being treated fairly, like, stay where you are then. Like, I totally understand that. But if you're looking around, you're like, I fucking hate my job. I hate the people I work with. They treat me like garbage. This company thinks I'm useless. Or not even useless, think I'm very useful, but don't think I'm worth fucking anything. Don't stay. Like, they think that you are disposable. They should be disposable to you. Like, it is just not the same as it used to be. A career is a myth. Like, a career doesn't mean you're at a company forever. A career is what you do over your life as a working person.
You talked before about your parents. They're both lawyers.
Yes. My mom and my stepdad. My stepdad is a trial attorney. He's had his own law firm for like 20 years now. He mostly works for he's a contract lawyer. And so he works really heavily with like the Michigan, Beverages and Distributors Association. So he does a lot of like liquor license contracting and things. We used to like walk into hotels when we were kids and he'd be like, look, there's my signature on their liquor license. We're like, oh shit, cool. That's dope. Thanks. And like, that is a privilege that I 1000% have and own, that like, I have a lawyer I can call at any time and have absolutely used that resource to my benefit. Like, I'm very lucky that I could call my stepdad and be like, this is bullshit, right? And he's like, yep, sure is. Like, that is a huge privilege in my life. So I just want to say, like, I totally recognize that. And then my mom is a paralegal. So she's also really good contracts. That's what she did for a really long time, was review legal contracts. So yeah, I've got like lawyer shit built into my blood, I think, in a way that I'm like, nah, well, okay. That's probably why I'm such a terrible arguer.
So are they passionate about that, or is that more like what you were talking about with your job now, where it's like, I'm good at this thing, so I'm doing it. Like, did they have hobbies outside of
their
job?
Yeah, they did. My mom danced and got us into dance as kids, and she loves theater. I mean, her brother was the one who was an actor, and her mm-hmm. dad did community theater for a really long time. So, and she was a dancer as a kid. She was like a point ballerina for a while. Another one of those, like, body betrays you and you're like, well, time to pick a different career. She used to be really into fashion. That's what she originally went to school for. And then decided that she was no longer going to go to school and she was going to have kids with my dad, my actual dad, is a gay man. So that didn't work out super well. Okay. My actual dad, he works for the Michigan Lottery. He's like a business manager. He just won an award through his company that his team was the best managed team in the whole world last year. He called to tell me that. And I was wow. like, damn, shit, dad, cool. Good for you. They like flew him out to Vegas. He had like a party out there. I was like, oh shit, cool. I was like, I barely know what you do, but I'm glad you're really good at it. And then his husband is an optometrist assistant. And like, they all have hobbies. They all like, they love dancing. They love going out to the movies. My stepdad loves to golf. He played softball for a really long time when I was a kid. My mom and I used to go to the movies all the time together, like as a she and I activity, just the two of us. Mm-hmm. My parents love Disney. We used to go there all the time, like I said earlier. My dad loved going to amusement parks, so he would take us every time we went to visit him. He lived in Delaware for 10 years. We would just drive up and down the East Coast and go to as many of the amusement parks as we could. So that was a big hobby of ours. And then my mom's a huge reader. My mom reads like, I think my sisters and I were talking about it the other day. I think she reads like legit like 200 books a year. She reads an outrageous amount. Where I got it from, for sure. Because she just reads stuff and is like, here's 18 books I think you'll enjoy. And I'm like, okay, thanks, Mom. I'll get to these in 8 years, I guess.
Is she retired?
No, she's not.
Wow. I was going to say, my dad's retired, so he has the time to read lots of books.
None of my parents are retired. They all still work. Like, I mean, they're pretty young. My dad is the oldest of all of my parents, and he's 55. Like,
oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. That cannot be right. Actually, I think it is right. I think he is like 55 or 56. Yeah, they get described as young all the time, and they love it. They're like, yes, we are. Thank you so much. My youngest sister just left for college, so I think they feel like old parents with her friends because she's only 18. It's like there is a 13-year gap between me and her, so I think that that's part of it. They're like, well, we're just going to keep doing this till we die, I guess. just kind of nice. I'm like glad that I got to see them all have hobbies, and like it made me a person who really values and needs work-life balance, having not had any as an actor for 15 years. Now I'm like really important. Do other shit. Have hobbies that aren't monetized.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, it's interesting, I think, the difference between the generations, because I very much saw that with my dad. You know, he had his job and then he had his hobbies that he did either at night or on the weekends. And that's what I thought work should be, that, you know, it's a thing you do to make money. And then there are the things that you do to be passionate afterwards. But at the same time, I have always been kind of like you, where I like wanted to work in theater or be a writer or whatever like that. And so it was kind of like, no, my job, I'm probably going to have to just do it until I drop dead from exhaustion. Yep. Kind of thing. And now the idea also, Stella talked about this a lot, like monetize your hobbies. Mm-hmm. And I very much envy her drive to do things. But at the same time, I'm just like, I sometimes, because I mean, I've talked about this many times on this podcast before, that working to do the wrestling podcast and the blog and writing for other websites and stuff like that, like it just killed me. It really killed me, and it killed the fun that used to be wrestling for me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I totally get that's ultimately why I decided that I didn't want theater to be my career anymore, because I got to the point where I was like, I hate this. I don't want to see anyone else's shows. I don't even want to audition for things that I'm not really interested in, which like you have to do as an actor. You just have to eat shit and audition for things so you can get paid. And like, it was just sucking my love of theater away. And I finally was like, theater is more important to me, and I think will be better for me long term if I can continue to enjoy it outside of a monetized career. And I never used to understand community actors. Like, if you're so good, why wouldn't you monetize this and make this your career? And now as an adult, I'm like, yep, that will be me in like 10 years. I will just go do community theater because I'll love it again and want to be a part of it and will feel stability in my work life that will allow for that. And like, oh, I was an idiot. But that's the folly of youth, right? Like, only people who are as committed as youths are to that, like, I can do this, can do it. Like, that's the whole deal, is you have to really go in and go deep on that kind of shit. And if you can hack it, you can hack it. And, like, that in itself is a skill that is unteachable. And, like, same thing with wrestling, man. It doesn't ever stop. It's a never-ending grind. And so if you want to love it, it's really difficult for it to be your job.
Yeah, or just even if it's something that you create content around, because there's so much of it, and to feel like you have to, I mean, there were days where I would watch, I mean, a progress show is like 4 hours long, and then I would immediately get on the phone with Courtney. We would record a podcast, which would probably be about 2 hours, and then I would spend all night editing that thing. And I wasn't getting paid to do it. And it was just sort of like, this is not fun. And if somebody went back and listened to the whole thing, which I would never recommend to someone, but if you were to do that, I think you could hear me getting progressively like more fed up as the episodes go on, where I'm just like, I really don't want to be talking about this
having
anymore.
Listened to that
like,
show, I don't even care. Yes, you can tell. When you guys announced you weren't doing it anymore, I was like, yeah, that makes sense. Seems about that.
They've been done for a long time. Yep,
absolutely. Yeah. I think it's nice now. Stella and I are talking. We both have a lot going on in our lives. And so we normally take a hiatus every year for like a month. And so coming up on our hiatus this year, we're like, we think we might do an additional 2 weeks. We normally do four, we'll probably do six. And we're like, we should like restructure and really think about this. And whenever we tell people we're taking this hiatus, they're like, oh, really? I'm really surprised. And part of me is like, I'm glad people are surprised. But on the other hand, like, I'm glad it's not bleeding out of my voice that I'm just like, wow, am I fed up and ready for not watching this for a minute? Like, I think that's the whole thing with wrestling too, just as like someone who talks about wrestling to someone else who talked about wrestling, like, it blows that there's no off season. Like, it just feels like it never fucking ends. I'm like, man, I love this, and I love wrestling. I love so much about it and so many of the people in it. It's like, it is just built to wear you down in a way that just doesn't feel conducive to long-term people sticking around. Like, I don't know. But people do it. I don't know. I guess the whole idea is you have to commit your whole life to it.
The other thing that I think is very interesting about wrestling, and could probably be applied to a lot of other things too, I just don't participate in them, is that when you're involved in a particular industry or community, there comes a point, and I think you'll understand this as a marketer, not just as a person who's part of this community, that you feel like you need to participate in the conversation that's going on.
Yes, totally.
I have to tell you, this will be completely irrelevant. I might even cut it out later. But yesterday, David Starr won the OTT championship, and I didn't need to comment on that. I just looked at it and was like, you know what? I don't need to say anything. There are so many people who have very strong opinions, or maybe not so strong opinions, but they feel the need to participate in the conversation. And I just don't. Every time I see something that's a hot topic, I actually think to myself, like, do you have anything valuable to add to this conversation? And then the next question is, and do you want to hear what people have to say back?
Yes.
And it's just like, no, I really don't. Like, it's not going to change my opinion. And also, like, I'm not really that involved anymore that I'm going to, what I have to say is going to be that interesting or important to anyone. So I have acknowledged that this thing is happening, and I am now going to go back to making chili or whatever the hell I was doing.
Yeah, that's part of what Stella and I have been talking about as well. Like, we have been doing Not Your Demographic for 4 years, over 4 years now. And like, the wrestling landscape and also the wrestling media landscape has just changed dramatically. And like, I'm super happy that we got to be a part of that tide and like a drop in that hurricane. Like, that's exciting. And I'm really glad that we got to be a part of that. But I do think that it's important for people who have been around for a minute inside of something to take a step back and look at something that they've been a part of and be like, and do exactly that of, is my voice still having the same impact that it did originally? Yes or no in both directions. How do I feel about that? Is my criticism or cultural critique or whatever new? Is it pushing people further in the directions of things that need to be talked about more? Yes or no in either direction? And how do I feel about that? Like, I think it's really important to evaluate, am I still doing what I set out to do? And if not, why did that change? And did I change it for the right reasons? And do I want to keep doing this if it, like, the conversation has just changed. It's just different now. And do I still want to be talking in a culturally critical way about something that does still need a lot of that, but in a completely different way than what we set out to do? Like, we kind of got sort of what we wanted. Are there other people who are more well positioned to get the rest of it? And it's not bad if I'm the person who can't complete the mission. I think that a lot of people look at cultural criticism and they're like, I did a little, but I didn't do everything I wanted. And that means I have to continue being the one to do this. And like, I don't think that that's productive all the time. And so I think that that's also part of wrestling media landscaping, of you have to look at that and be like, there are so many more people who feel empowered to talk about how they aren't being represented. Is it maybe better if they're the ones talking about it because people are listening to them? I think that it's better to put people's voices forward who should have been allowed, who should have been listened to before, but weren't, quite frankly, and are now being listened to. Like, I don't want to be like the white feminist who's like, I'm just going to continue doing this because I'm the one who's been pushed forward. Like, no, I'm going to age out at some point. And I think everyone kind of needs to feel like that's okay. That's, I think, another part of that like career myth of like any kind of exit is a failure. Like, that's not true. It's just straight up not true.
I also think that people neglect to recognize that sometimes your value is not just in all the stuff that you've done, but your ability to let somebody kind of, I love that gif of like the women pulling each other up and it just keeps looping, you know, so like someone pulls someone up from the bottom of the image and then that person gives the other person like an alley-oop up out of the top of the image. That's important too. And you don't, this is a big thing, and it's been really hard for me to wrap my head around it, especially within wrestling, but like, you don't always get to go up.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes there's a stopping point, and it's not necessarily because of a glass ceiling or something like that. It's just because like your contribution to moving all of this onwards has an end point. And it doesn't mean you're no longer relevant. It just means like now it's time for you to focus on something else, or it's time for you to use the platform that you've built to put the focus on someone else.
Absolutely.
And recognizing all, honestly, the nicest thing that anyone says now, and I really genuinely mean this, is the people who say like, you're the person who got me into whatever.
Yes.
Like, you're the person who introduced me to this thing. And I'm like, great, because that's all I really needed to do. Mm-hmm. If I introduce one other woman or one other queer person to wrestling, then that's great, because then they get to pick it up and take it wherever they want. Like, I'm never going to have all the answers. I'm never going to be able to fix all the problems. I don't even know all the problems.
Yeah,
and
totally.
So recognizing that there are limitations to your role within something is really important too.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. And I think that that's like, it's something that people understand instinctively when they talk about other things that annoy them. But when it's like your own thing, it's like, but no, it's again, it's like being told over and over as an actor child, this is not going to work. You should do something else. And thinking like, no, I'm the one that this time it's going to be me and I'm going to make it. And sometimes one in a billion times that's actually right. And I think that's true of what we're talking about, where like you said, there's an endpoint for most people, and some people and a lot of people are like, but not me, I'm gonna be the fucking Dave Meltzer or whatever, I'm gonna be around forever. And it's like, okay, well, there's only one of those, and that dude's still alive and for some reason still relevant. And like, are you gonna be the one that does that? Maybe, but like, why? Can't we restructure? Can we do this differently? Like, can't we think differently about the way that we all fit into this landscape? Like, it doesn't just need to be out for me in particular in the end. Like, I'm okay with the fact that I'm not going to make it all the way to the end. Like, that's just how it works. It's the same fucking thing with like climate change and protecting our planet. Like, I'm not going to make it to the time where we colonize another planet. But if I don't give a fuck and our planet dies because of actions I'm taking directly inhibiting those people being able to live on this planet to get to that point, like, that's bad. I don't want to do that. I want to be like a link in that helps lead people forward. Like, just because I personally cannot see the end results of it, it doesn't mean that it's not good. I think we just have such a limited attention span on how far things go forward past us. It's like, no, my time ends when I end. Like, no, that's not how that works. Not at all.
And I think that's true in any industry and with any career too, that it's not you coming in at an entry level position and eventually owning the company. Like,
doesn't
the cases
happen.
Of that happening. Yeah. The cases of that happening are very rare, if ever at all.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you're not prepared to top out somewhere in the middle, you are not ready for life to come at you real fast.
Absolutely.
And I think that is incredibly important. Setting goals for yourself and saying like, I want to achieve this thing before I move on is great. But if a really awesome opportunity comes to you before you achieve that thing, like, you need to ride the wave.
Absolutely. 100%.
I have in my life encountered a lot of people who are really good at what they do, or really passionate, or really just in some cases just emotionally attached to either the people they work with or the work that they're doing, and they feel really conflicted when another opportunity comes up. And it's just kind of like, why would anybody with any sense is not going to look at the situation and think that you're just screwing over the people that you're working with, or you're ungrateful for all the opportunities that have come before. But it's kind of like, this is how life works.
Yeah, totally.
You know, you might have a really great landlord, but if suddenly the opportunity to buy your own home and it's within your price range and it's in an area you want to live or whatever, that doesn't mean you don't like your landlord and you're not grateful for having, you know, the place that you've lived in for all of it. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. If you applied that same scenario to other things in life, it doesn't make any sense at all.
No, so, absolutely not. I totally agree.
This is a very different conversation than I thought we were going to have, which is great. I like that a lot.
That's me.
So besides doing the wrestling podcast, what are your hobbies outside of work?
I dance. I take I haven't been recently because I went through two different shoulder injuries. But when I'm like fully healthy, and now I am, and I've started this job and I'm like acclimating a little more, I'm going to start taking classes again. But I take modern dance at like an intermediate level. jazz, like classical jazz at an intermediate level. And then I occasionally take advanced musical theater classes still, because I still really enjoy that style. I take classes at a semi-professional company a lot of the time. And then I also have an instructor I really like who is transitioning from working at one studio to opening her own studio literally down the road from where I live. She was like, I'm sorry, I'm moving this. I'm like, it's going to be a little further north and a little further west. She was like, do you ever go off of this stop? And I was like, yeah, Nancy, I live off of that stop. She was like, oh shit, what? Her studio is going to be, I can only get there by walking. There's no faster way to get there. That's so awesome. I'm very excited about that coming up. Yeah. So I do a lot of dance. I read a lot. I keep meticulous records of everything I've read since I was 16. 'Cause I'm a fucking weirdo. I've read 73 books so far this year. I also make art. I'm actually sitting at my art space desk right now. I make like weird collage art. Right now I've been taking a lot of old black and white Hollywood photos and making them into collage pieces. I post a lot of that stuff on my Instagram, NYDUrgency. And I, funnily enough, that's not a monetized hobby, but people keep asking me if they can buy my stuff. And so I think I'm going to open up an Etsy store and just sell some of it. I have so much of it now that I'm like, I don't really need to keep all of this. So another like stumbled backwards into a monetized thing in my life, I guess.
That's awesome. I really liked the ones that had images from Singing in the Rain, because that's one of my favorite.
Yes, that's one of my favorite movies as well.
That's how I learned about the very tall wonder that is Sid Charisse.
Oh my God. She rules so much. Mm-hmm. So much. I love her. Her dance style is just beautiful. It's so good.
And also her aesthetic is really great. And this sounds so dumb to probably all the other people who are listening on this podcast right now. But when I was trying to create like an aesthetic that people, this way, when I went to wrestling shows, people could recognize me from like pictures on Twitter or whatever. The really short bangs, like that was Sid Charisse. Like the really short bangs and the really short bob kind of thing. That was a direct ripoff of Sid Charisse in Singing in the Rain.
It's a fucking great look. I had my hair cut like that for a while too. Although when I styled my hair, I often tried to look more like Dana Scully. I had her season 6 haircut forever, for a really long time when I was like 18.
Hey, redheads of a feather, you know.
Like, dude, she rules. That's my fucking favorite show still to this day. So I guess it was a good choice. Better than the Rachel, I guess. Although now as like a 31-year-old, I'm like, would I get the Rachel? It's so stupid that I'm like, I kind of like it.
I have a very layered haircut that is based off of a picture of my mother from like 1981.
I love your hair right now. I think it looks so good. I'm so jealous of your gray. Every time I see you, I'm like, ugh, why can't I have that?
We had an office party on Friday and some strange woman came up to me and was like, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but is that your real hair color? And I think I need like a recording and I can just hit a button that's like, yes, this is my real hair color. And it took me 2 years to grow it out. Yes, I used to color it. And no, if you grow your hair out, it probably won't look like this. I'm sorry. Like, that's the reality. Yeah.
It just looks so good. It's like textbook good growing too.
So because you work in marketing, I think this is just a really fascinating thing, because when I was looking around the office on Friday, I was thinking about the aesthetic of people, because somebody actually asked me, like, do you cover, because I am heavily tattooed and you also have a lot of visible tattoos like on your arms and stuff. Yep. Do you ever feel the need to cover your tattoos or change your aesthetic for work?
Yes, definitely. I 100% do. Part of it with me is that the last company that I worked at, one of the benefits of it was that they did not give a fuck about what I wore at all. Like, I could legit roll up in pajamas and they would have been cool with that, because I never had any kind of client facing role. And I was so good at my job that people were like, whatever, she just sits at her desk and doesn't speak to anyone for 8 hours a day. Like, let her do whatever she fucking wants, I guess. And so I would be comfortable rolling up into my job now in like leggings and a long sleeve t-shirt. And like, I would feel comfortable doing that because I also work for a burlesque company. Like, I don't give a fuck. Like, it doesn't bother me, but I understand that that's like not appropriate for the company I'm working at now. And so I definitely have to like think consciously about at least going up to business casual for me, which is just so sad, but it's true because I'm just like a lazy dirtbag. I have, my aesthetic is I look like a 90s mom on vacation. Like, that's not necessarily the best thing to wear to the office. So I definitely have to think about that. And when I interview, I cover my tattoos. I almost always wear something that I'll usually wear like a long sleeve turtleneck because you just never know. Some people say like, oh no, it's cool. We don't actually care. But people will judge you in interviews for tattoos in a way that's just like, this is such bullshit. It means nothing. Like, unless I'm throwing up some kind of like awful tattoo that has like a really awful meaning, like, yeah, that I can understand, but like, who gives a fuck about my Battlestar Galactica tattoo? No one even knows what it means. Like, it doesn't matter. And like, half the time now people, I'll like roll up my sleeves in the office and people will ask me about my tattoos because they're like, oh, they're cool, I like that, I have this one here. And it's like, oh, all of us are covered in tattoos now. It doesn't matter. But there's still that like first barrier to entry that throws up this very weird and unnecessary barrier where it's like no one actually gives a fuck about tattoos, but for some reason it's still something that's like prioritized in like a subconscious way when you're interviewing for something. Another way that women and minorities get treated worse, probably. Like, I don't personally know a lot of men who have had that same issue in interviewing where they're like, oh, my tattoos absolutely were judged in a way, but I have experienced it as a woman, and I know a lot of other women who have experienced that as well, and it blows. It shouldn't happen, but it does.
It's always really mind-boggling to me too, because I've had this conversation with a lot of women that I would consider pretty strong women, people who are very comfortable with the decisions that they've made about their appearance, mm-hmm. who then are like, no, I feel like I have to, even if nobody's ever said straight up, you have to cover your tattoos.
Absolutely.
And it's just like, it literally blows my mind that I'm like, how is this? I don't even know where to begin. Like, how is this a thing that we all feel the need to hide these things that we intentionally got as representations of who we are that people can look at? Like, I need to cover up the part of me that's most me is really what it feels like.
Oh, absolutely. We want you to have a generic and samesies look as everyone else. And like, some of it I understand. Like, I understand dressing appropriately for a business casual office. Like, some of it really is like there are just people everywhere, and if you, for instance, have like a super low cut shirt on, or this is an example outside of my own office, but I know someone who works with a woman who they've nicknamed inappropriate dresser because she'll wear like crop tops to the office, and I'm like, you know, respect, I like that, and I personally would do something like that too, but I can understand why it would be super distracting if someone rolls up in like beachwear. I'm like, that would be a little weird. I think I would find it a little distracting, but then at the same time, part of that is also like, you just have to modulate that and be like, if everyone is doing it, it's not a big deal and it will stop being distracting. If your eye is being drawn to it, it's because it is an outlier, and there's something about office culture that's like, crush the outlier, make it all the same.
I can kind of understand to a certain degree if you are, especially in something like marketing, right? If you work in an industry where you are dealing with clients
all the time,
presenting a visual that looks kind of similar, right? A group of people from your office who are all dressed in like a comparable way. That's fine. I don't have any problem with that. But like, in the process, to say I'm intentionally going to pick items that cover up the parts of me that might set me apart from this group is also just kind of like, I don't know. That's why I really like my hair, because I think my hair, it makes a very strong statement about me.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's part of like, I also understand that I as a person make a statement right away visually because I never wear makeup, like fucking ever, unless I'm performing. And that's not like a political statement of any kind. I am just deeply lazy and really don't care to do it I love the way makeup looks on almost anyone else, but I'm not very good at it. And I'm, again, deeply lazy. So I don't wear makeup like fucking ever. And so I feel like that's part of it with me too, is like, I wear glasses all the time. I haven't worn contacts in years because I have horrible astigmatism and I hate wearing them. I can only wear them for like a couple hours before I get really uncomfortable. So I wear glasses all the time. And so I feel like I get this like visual read immediately. And so if I wear things outside of a business environment wardrobe template. It's a little more noticeable too, because people are like, oh, I've already noticed this thing about you that's different, and now I'm looking for this other thing, which sucks, but it's like a thing that I feel like I'm definitely aware of in a working environment too. And part of it, I think too, is that I'm new to this environment, and I'm sure as I'm there longer, I will feel more comfortable like rolling up my sleeves, and people will just be used to the sight of my tattoos. Or like when it becomes nice out again and I start wearing dresses, people will be able to see some of my other tattoos. I think it'll be interesting to see how that reaction goes once they like already know me as a person. And the first thing that they're not making a judgment on are these pieces of art that they may have independent feelings about. I think that ultimately is what it comes down to, is that the longer you're in a place and the more people are familiar with your look, they're like, oh, that's just what your skin looks like. But it's like a puzzle that people feel they have to solve when they see a tattoo that they don't know right away what it means. So I think that that's part of it.
I'm going to ask you one question. If you don't answer, that's right. Totally fine. Your Twitter account is locked.
Yes, my Twitter account is locked. I loved having an open account for a really long time. Part of it was that I was up for a position at a magazine. It was an academic magazine, and I got all the way through the process, and then the board looked at my Twitter and were like, no. And they wound up not hiring anyone for that position, because I really think they wanted it to be me. They wanted me to do a very specific role I would have been really good at, but the board was full of old white dudes. They were like, no, fucking absolutely not. You cannot hire this woman. And so I locked my account after that, because I was like, all right, well, I want a job. I need to get a job at some point, so I'm going to lock it. I don't know. I still have it locked now, because part of it is, I think, until I decide exactly what I want my role going forward in wrestling cultural criticism to be, part of it is that I just like to talk shit in my locked Twitter. Like, I like don't even care. Like, people request to follow me and I'm like, sure, whatever. If you don't have like offensive shit in your bio, like, for the most part, people that find my account like know what they're in for, which is kind of nice. Yeah, it's I kind of love it, because everybody talks about like having an alt and having a secondary locked account, and I'm like, no, I just do the exact same shit I did when my account was unlocked, but now I just do it to a much smaller audience. Also, I have just loved over the last 8 months watching my follower count just go down and down and down and down, and no one's replacing it. And there's something that's so freeing about that. Like, having to be worried about follower counts and shit, like, it gave me so much anxiety, and I'm just not that person. Again, I'm not good at the hustle of certain parts of things. Like, that's why Stella is my partner, because she is really good at that shit and I am not. And so it's been really relaxing in many ways to be like, I don't have to think about this. I don't have, like you were saying, like, I can talk about something and I don't have to try to change someone's mind all the time. And like, that's fine. I don't need that to be my role right now. Like, I have other things I need to focus on. And so maybe when I'm more interested in having that like back and forth, I'll unlock it. But and also, it's not beach season anymore, so I'm just posting insane photos of me going to the beach 8 days in a row, so I probably have an unlocked account now. And my Instagram is not private. My Instagram is mostly photos of art and books and me at the beach, but not inappropriate photos. Not that they were inappropriate on Twitter, but like that people could, and my job could look at. I showed my Instagram to someone I was interviewing with once. She was just like flipping through my Instagram. I was like, man, I'm glad this is not my Twitter. I'll show you my Instagram. That's fine. But like, please God, don't look through my Twitter. I've had it for too long. I think that's my problem. I was an early adopter, and so I used Twitter back when it really was like just your friends, and I never really got over that. So I think I use Twitter in a way that's probably not great anymore for like having a big social following. Like, I could start scratch from something else, but I love my account. I want it to just be my own ramblings. That's exactly what it is. That's why I like it.
I was actually just gonna say that, like, I think I got a Twitter account in like 2008, and the one that it's like my actual name, and I went back and deleted like a lot of it, not because there was anything that I was like horrified by, but it was a lot of stuff where I was like, who is this even to? Like, yeah. What is this about? Like, it's just random thoughts that I'm having, or because there were only 5 people following me, they knew that I was talking to them. So, yeah. It's, you know, I was basically using it as like group text.
Yes, and totally. That's really what it felt like.
Yeah, I sort of like deleted all of that stuff. And also when I went back, because I had locked the Lady J Twitter for a really long time, and I went back and deleted years off of it. And I have no regrets about that at all. I thought that because I am definitely the kind of person who's like, I can't throw out this piece of paper. I might need it someday. So going, it was actually incredibly cathartic to just be like, no, I'm just going to blow all of 2014 through early 2017 away. It was great because I just thought to myself, like, honestly, I don't know that I feel the same way that I did then. And I don't know what, like, also, it's very common now for people to be like, let me just secretly dig back through all of your old tweets where you had some pretty stupid opinions about things. And it's like, you know what? I grew up. Somebody changed my mind, you know, like I came to my senses and I thought some pretty dumb things once upon a time. We've all been 19. Like I wasn't doing anything that was deeply offensive, but it was just like, maybe that wasn't I just wasn't the same person then. So my perspective on life was really different. And now it's just kind of like, no, I like want to buy a house one day. I have different feelings about my finances. I have different feelings about everything in life. And so, I don't envy people who are, you know, quote unquote, Gen Z, whose like entire existence has been on the internet, who are now trying to go into the workforce. And it's just kind of like, wow, dude, I hope you've never, ever fucked up even a little bit once, because it's all out there forever.
Yeah, but in some ways, that's kind of nice. I feel like it's going to take just the next like 4 or 5 years of kids graduating from high school and like really entering the workforce, like just the sheer numbers of people who all of that is accessible. It'll be kind of like the, I mean, this is shitty and this is like a not good thing that is happening, but that like push for like right to work, which is just a clever way to disguise, trying to get people into, like specialty and industrial training and then not unionize them so that it can like slowly take power away from unions, that there's a big push for that, which is bad and should not be happening. And if you're going through like more like manual labor training, if you're going through those kind of programs, you should still be unionizing. That's the smart way to do it. But I think that that's what's going to happen with children who have lived on the internet for so long, that those sheer numbers are just going to overwhelm the workforce. And it's just not going to be a big deal in like 4 or 5 years. Because everyone's shit is everywhere. It's like that idea of like, there are people who have naked photos of them that are discoverable on the internet, and we're supposed to be super ashamed of this, but like legit almost everyone has taken naked photos of them at some point. And at some point, all of that is just like, everyone will just have it available and it won't be a big deal anymore. We're not there yet, but like that time is rapidly coming, and it's because Gen Z is just going to start leaking out into the real world, and that like that is going to make a huge difference. Also, we are the first national election where kids who were born after 2001, after the towers fell, can vote and are like rapidly entering the voting pool too. Like these next years are going to be fucking weird, super weird. And it's because Gen Z is going to be out making decisions like real adults who have all of this shit that they've been watching for their whole lives and like, wait, what? Like, it's going to be a time. I'm glad to be alive, I guess.
Yeah, a whole generation of kids who are like, how come I grew up thinking that it might be possible for someone to come into my school and shoot
me? Who've just been doing active shooter drill. Like, I did active shooter drills from, Columbine happened when I was in fifth grade. And so we did like one or two a year until I graduated from high school, basically. But my sisters had them 4 times a year the entire time they went to school. So for 13 years. And like, that is just trauma we have etched into those kids. And like, they are fucking mad. They are so mad in a way that like, where I'm very politically active and I have been a part of that since I was my sister's age, since I was 18, and I could be a part of it. my time is different now. Like, I need to stand aside and let those voices come up of kids who are like, this is fucking unacceptable. And like, I really feel that in that stage of my life where there's a hobby that's not monetized. I'm super into like local politics and support the Chicago teachers union strike. And I think that that's an important thing to be involved in your community, especially when you can create a work-life balance, like being involved in making sure that the world around you is going better is a good goal to have to like make you feel more stabilized inside of your careers as well. Just like a little cherry on the end there.
It was nice of you to bring it back like that so that now I can say, Erin, tell the people where they can find you on the internet should you want them to do so.
You can find me on my podcast, the Not Your Demographic podcast that I co-host with Stella Cheeks, who was also on this show. Her episode was great. You should give it a listen. She and I release once a week right now. Like I said earlier in this episode, we have a hiatus coming up, but we're like keeping people abreast of it. We're not like just going to disappear and be like, peace out, bitches. Like we also have a Patreon at patreon.com/notyourdemopod where we'll continue to put stuff up while we're on said hiatus. We have lots of crazy shit on our Patreon. We have a bunch of, we're doing a series called Every Mania Ever where we go back and we started at WrestleMania 1 and then we talk about whether or not it holds up. Spoiler, lots of them don't. Lots of them are really bad and we have not even gotten like really into the Attitude Era yet. We're on 16 right now. We have a couple of movie reviews up about wrestling adjacent movies. Sure. We watched a Jesus movie because of Shawn Michaels. It was a trip. And then we also have a bunch of short stories up called NYD After Dark, where Stella and I tell all of our worst dating horror stories. Sure. Some of my favorite, they're mostly me. It's mostly my episodes. A lot of them are very ridiculous. So we have all that up at patreon.com/notyourdemopod. You can come check out my Twitter. Again, if your bio's not offensive, you can request to follow me and I just approve people most of the time. I'm at Erngen C. If you can spell it, good for you. I'm not going to spell it for you. You can also find my art photos on my Instagram at NYD Erngen C. Apparently, I have an Etsy shop I will be building at some point. I am the head stagehand for a company called Plan 9 Burlesque, which again, Stella is the owner operator of. And they have a bunch of great media out on the internet that you can find as well, which have a bunch of really cool pictures if you're into nerdlesque, and you should be because it's fun. I think that's it. I'm used to doing all my internet shit with Stella, so I'm like, I remember some of the things. This one's relevant to me, I guess.
Maybe what I'll do is go back and just cut Stella's part out and then just put your like Instagram handle in and just put her doing the like, you know, her 30-second thing that she knows how to do at the end of every episode in there.
Yeah, she's like, here it is. Here's all of our information. And I'm like, yeah, sure.
I think we have a podcast, right? What's it called?
That conversation with Erin was so much fun. I really appreciated that she picked up the ball at the beginning and just ran with it. That was a lot of fun. And she had a lot of important things to say in there. If you'd like to talk about this episode, which I would love to hear what you have to say, you can get at me on Twitter at @TheLadyJSays. You can get at me on Instagram at @TheLadyJSlays. Or you can always email me, TheLadyJSays@gmail.com. Don't forget to rate, subscribe, review, all of that stuff. Let me know if there's anywhere on the internet that you listen to podcasts that you can't get this. I'll make sure it gets on there. And be sure that you come back here next week. I will definitely be here. Gizmo will be in a candy coma, recovering from Halloween. And we'll see you then. Happy November, everyone. Bye.